My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. Kind of a touching thing. I just remembered. Victor brought it back to mind. I guess, in many ways, what he says is true. I never met a man I didn't like until I met Victor's father. Something about that guy just kind of pissed me off. See, Victor, you can't be nice in this world. The world is cruel and vicious. But I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be at this roundup. John came back to California last year after this and said what a nice group he'd been down here and what a nice bunch of people they were. And he certainly was accurate. I'm glad to see a lot of old friends here tonight, this afternoon. And see some new friends. And I really had one little surprise. I live next door to a boob that, he's nice. He lurks around our backyard and hurts our dogs from time to time. And one thing about going on a trip, so it's kind of nice to get away from all those things and find a little freedom and peace of mind. I came in here tonight, and he was sitting right behind me, for Christ's sake. I said, "What are you doing here?" And he gave me one of his usual answers. Nice to have you with us, Ed. Especially my dear friends from Atlanta and people from hither and yon, John Patty from Missouri, this goof from Richardson, Texas that I drew for, $450. He came over like this. I was going to say, "Here, have something." I never had any luck in Texas anyway. I don't know why I'd start now. But this is an interesting subject that you've taken for the affair. I'm sorry that I've missed the meeting so far. As some of you know, I was down in Mexico yesterday, and I had to go back to Los Angeles last night and get on a plane early this morning and get here. So all I heard was John's talk, which is a very good and thoughtful presentation of the traditions. I understand, though, that your speaker last night, Peg, gave an excellent talk, and I know she does. She always gives an excellent talk. And she's one of the few speakers I know who I've heard many times, and I always like to hear again because she presents things a little bit differently. Well, that's really true. You'd be surprised. A lot of people out there give the same talk word for word. Pretty soon after you, that's what my problem is. Sometimes when I lose my way, I have to look in the front row, and they're going. Oh, yes. Karen this morning, who God spoke through me when I named her a few months ago the human hummingbird, because I think her wings go about 1,000 beats a minute at rest, you know, just brrrr. Sometimes when I can't sleep, I think of her giving a talk and think of all the work her mind must do, and I just... And tomorrow, I'm sure Burns will send us all home spiritually fit. So, I'm just kind of the fill-in between the $450 drawing and the dance. I would have preferred not such a strong applause of agreement. Could anyone say, "No, no"? Brown noser. But anyway, I'm very glad to be here. It's a very good subject, back to basics, because I think, as John mentioned a little bit in his talk of the traditions today, and we hear as you travel around quite a bit, Alcoholics Anonymous needs continual redressing of its aims and goals to get back towards the norm, because it's made up of extremists. And we are all extremists in different directions and have been. And we all secretly know we are not quite like the others. And we all know that AA needs a few tiny corrections in its path to make it just a little more applicable and to get a little more on the roll. And a lot of these old fuddy-duddy rules were good maybe in 1935, but for the young, modern, dynamic alcoholic, you need to open a vista. And it's just enough to make your ass tired, I'll tell you. And it's hard to remember that the thing that makes Alcoholics Anonymous what it is because it does remain constant and remains what it does better than anything has ever done in the history of the world. Only one other time, I'm sure most of you old timers know this, some of you newcomers might not, but they've been treating alcoholism. They didn't know what it was for 4,000 years. They thought at one time people were possessed by the devil. They'd exorcise them, sometimes kill them. And they'd send them away, and they just thought they were willful and crazy and nutty. And there have always been a few thoughtful people of every generation think there must be something wrong here with these people. We can't see what it is. And in 1840, six guys got together in a bar in Baltimore. And for some reason, nobody knows why, the first half of that century, the 1800s, was the biggest per capita drinking period in American history. And these guys were really having a bad time. They decided to see if they could help each other stay sober. They'd all taken the pledge. They'd all gone to church. They'd all done things. They'd all had doctors. But then maybe we can help each other. And they started to help each other. And some other guys got involved. And pretty soon they got another little couple guys. Then pretty soon they had a little chapter. Then pretty soon they had another little chapter. And pretty soon they had a little chapter up in Philadelphia. Then they had a little chapter down in Washington. And so people went to New York, and they had five or six chapters in Washington, or New York, and Boston. At the end of a year, they had all kinds of chapters all over. At the end of the second year, they arbitrarily took Washington. They called themselves the Washingtonians because they named it after Washington, who was the first man to do what he did, was to start his country, and they were trying to stay sober by helping each other. And they chose his birthday as their anniversary date. Their anniversary date actually was in March, but they arbitrarily took February 22nd. And in 1842, there were chapters everywhere. So many, in fact, that they got out a letter at the end of 1841 to everybody. Said, on February 22nd, we're all going to have our second anniversary all over the country. We suggest that you get a local speaker, someone who tries to understand at least what it's about, not necessarily a drinker himself, and come down and talk and get a better understanding of what we're doing. So all over the country, February 22nd, 1842. In fact, the speaker they chose in Springfield, Ohio, was a young lawyer named Abraham Lincoln. And he came down and gave a talk. And I have his talk on the wall of my office because it was really a remarkably insightful talk. He didn't really have any idea what alcoholism was. But he seemed to grope for it. At least he tried to understand. He was saying something to the effect of, it's somehow as though you have a different type of thirst than I do. It is not due to my moral superiority or any sort of intellectual integrity. It is a different thirst, and I'm sure if I had the thirst that you seem to have, I would be on that side of the podium rather than this side. But since I'm here, I must admire you and hope that you can continue your efforts. So it progressed. By 1845, there were chapters everywhere. The bottom estimate of membership was 500,000 sober alcoholics. Now, that may doesn't sound like very much compared to AA's 2 million, but after 5 years, AA didn't even have 1,000 yet. Wasn't even close to 1,000. And here's 500,000, and they'd evolve something kind of like AA. People from this group would go and talk to that group, and when someone was sick from drinking, they'd send 3 or 4 people, they'd tell them about how they were all trying to stay sober together, and people got together, they worked on projects, and they did things together. And then they made the decision in 1845, which seems correct. It's intellectually correct. And that's what people want to do today and have wanted to do in AA all along, because it's intellectually correct. If we can help alcoholics so well, why should we not try to help other people with other problems that aren't getting enough help? We can help them. We can thrust their cares behind them. So they began a new policy of trying to help people in various projects. They began to work with narcotics addicts, people who didn't have a drinking problem, just narcotics. Not the kind of narcotics we know now, heroin and opium, but opium and laudanum, not heroin and cocaine like today. And they got some people who were engaged, they got caught up in the temperance movement. There began to be a big temperance movement. Look, if these drunken people can stay sober, maybe the secret is to wipe out alcohol whatsoever and give everybody a chance for happiness. So a lot of them got active in the temperance movement. Some of them got active in the anti-slavery movement. Some of them got active in religious movements, but taking under the name of the Washingtonians. And they surged off, and they were prepared to change the world. And by 1848, the Washingtonians were extinct. All of them back on the street. All of them died drunk, I suppose. Most of them. I have a book home written by one of the very, very few survivors, written in 1862, and he couldn't understand what the hell had happened. We were all doing so well, and we were helping so many people, and he talked about trips he had talked to give talks. You know, we whine because we have to jump on an airplane early in the morning, come to Huntsville. I mean, he got in his horse and drove and took a boat down the river and got rented a horse, and, you know, really tough. I said, we all were eager to do this. And yet, people just, all of a sudden, things began to change. Don't know why. Never did know why. But they became extinct. And I'll tell you, that was the only movement at that time that had ever helped alcoholics, and it had now just gone out of business. And I'll tell you how extinct it became. In the early 1940s, Alcoholics Anonymous was shaking itself apart. There were all kinds of problems going on in the late 1930s, early 1940s. Bill is always very kind when he writes the histories of AA. He doesn't mention any really bad things. He just kind of elides them. But there really were really bad times. I mean, there were, just an example in passing. Bill's right-hand man, a man who had, in a sense, had been closer to him than Dr. Bob, a man named Hank P., who was his right-hand man in New York. And this Hank P., fancied that Bill had done him an emotional wrong. And he got brooding about it in 1938, early 1939. And finally, in fact, it was his office Bill used to write the big book. His secretary typed it. And this guy got thinking about this damn Bill Wilson. And he finally got drunk. And he felt so strongly about it that he spent some time traveling from AA group to AA group warning them against Bill Wilson and what a dirty man he was and what a filthy person he was. Now, that's tough when you have just a fledgling little movement of people hanging on, and here's his best friend saying he's no good. There were people doing all sorts of things. One of the funny things, it's kind of an amusing thing now, but it wasn't amusing at the time. Some guy in Florida was selling memberships in AA. They wrote to him, said, how could you sell memberships in AA? And he had a very good reason, and there's absolutely nothing really wrong with it. He said, in my opinion, the people in Florida anyway, when they get something for nothing, they don't appreciate it. When they pay for it, they listen. And I don't keep the money. I send it to New York. I'm not doing it for my own sake. I'm doing it to help them. There are all types of people. Some people have their names in the papers. I'm a member of AA. Catcher of the Cleveland Indians, some other people. Bill Wilson even tried it for a while until it made him too uncomfortable. All sorts of things. People fighting each other. By this time, the people in Akron were hating the people in New York because they'd gotten away from the four absolutes of the Oxford movement. And the people in New York thought the people in Akron were a bunch of goofs hung up in the Oxford movement. And the people in Chicago were mad at the people in New York, so they would only write to Akron. They wouldn't write to New York. And the people in California would not have anything to do with Akron. They wrote to New York. I mean, and people were getting drunk and dying all the time, and nobody could understand why. Somebody wrote Bill Wilson a letter. Said, we're starting to look like the Washingtonians. We're going to blow up. And to show you how extinct the Washingtonians were, Bill Wilson had never heard of them. The most important single movement in the history of the world about alcoholics And it was so interesting, he hadn't heard of them. So he got some books, and he read about it. And he began to realize, my God, we are getting like the Washingtonians. For the best of motives, we are killing ourselves. And he didn't know what to do about it. So we sat down, and the next year or two, he talked to a lot of people, thought about it, listened to people complain. And as a result of that, he wrote the 12 Traditions. It's hard to remember sometimes that these 12 traditions just didn't come out like the steps, some wonderful thing we should do. Each of them are based on hundreds and thousands of people like you and me getting drunk and dying, doing them a different way. Some of them based on AA, most of them based on the experience of the Washingtonians as it manifested itself in our day. That's why it's kind of amusing today that to hear people are bored, as Johnny said, by the traditions. They don't realize that is really, they are not just do-gooderism suggestions. They are your life and mine, pal. And if you don't follow them, you'll be down the toilet and no one will even remember who in the hell you were. But that's the way it goes around here. But AA, even in the late 1940s, he published these one by one in the grapevine in the long form, as John mentioned today, not the short form. That's just the abbreviation they use later. But the long form, which in the back of the book, you ought to read it. It's very, very interesting. The members of AA took great umbrage to it. We don't want any goddamn rules! We're here to find love! Put out by those snots in New York. Just typical down-to-earth group ethics. And so finally, Bill and Dr. Bob, thank God they always got along together. They got together and said, our people are so diverse, they don't understand how similar they are and how we're all fighting the same battle. Perhaps we could find one unifying thing. We could have a big meeting somewhere and get them all together once. So they had their followers work it out. And, of course, alcoholics then were like they are now. People in Akron said, we'll go to a convention, but we won't go to New York, so just write it off. And the people in New York, not to be outdone in maturity, said, we'll go to a convention, but we won't go to Akron. So Bill and Dr. Bob got together, and with Solomon-like wisdom, they selected Cleveland. Okay, and off they went. That was a very interesting meeting. I have the tapes home of that convention. Very funny little tapes, but they're tapes. Dr. Bob gave his last talk. He was dying of cancer at that time, you know. He gave that very famous talk. Most of you, I'm sure, read it. Some of you heard it. He talks about, let's leave the scientific aspects of alcoholism to the scientists who wish to study it. He said, we all know what Alcoholics Anonymous is. It is love and service. We don't have to check out what love is. We have to check out what service is. It's very obvious. And we want to guard that erring member, the tongue, so that we will use it kindly when we judge one another. And let us never be too busy to stop and give a pat on the back to the man behind us. Because none of us would be here if the man ahead of us hadn't taken a moment to explain to us and show us what's going on. Touching and beautiful talk. He died a few months thereafter. Just in passing, I don't know how I got off this, but you might as well, we have no place to go except to dance. And I can't dance with my bad legs, so let's stay here all night. Screw it. I said to the doctor, I said, when this torn ligament is operated on next Tuesday, doctor, will I be able to dance? He said, yes, you will. I said, gee, that's funny. I never could before. Anyway, I think he's going to do it without anesthetic now. See how funny you think this is? But to remind you that we are made up of human beings and always have been. Many years later, I was at the International Convention in Miami Beach, 1970. And there was a big, it was a wonderful convention. I was thrilled because I was asked to speak on noon of July 4th. I just felt so honored to be there. And the first speaker that morning, by an odd coincidence, was the guy who had taken me to my first meeting in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And the last speaker that was Chuck Chamberlain from Los Angeles, the late night meeting. And at 8 o'clock in the evening, Bill Wilson scheduled to give his annual Friday night talk. I mean, his every one of these conventions. I heard the first one in 1960, next 1965 in Toronto, and now here's this auditorium in Miami Beach, 15,000 people jammed in there waiting to hear Bill. Boy, just excited, just a golden moment. And the guy came out and said, "I'm sorry, Bill Wilson is too sick to talk. He had bad emphysema. He cannot talk." And you heard 15,000 people go, "Oh." He said, we do have a substitute. I thought to myself, I'm glad I'm not him. They brought some guy out. I'd like to introduce Jim. Poor bastard, it wasn't his fault. We didn't care. All of us came from dysfunctional homes. I came from a dysfunctional state. Anyway. And so this guy gave a talk. We thought, well, maybe. On the way back to the hotel, I was walking with a little guy named John McHugh from Pittsburgh, who got sober 1945 or 46 out with Dr. Bob. And I said, "God, that's too bad. We'll never hear Bill talk again." He said, "Ah, hell, he'll talk at this convention." I said, "No, he won't. I know, I've met someone from the World Service Office. I'm telling you, John, he's not going to talk." "I'm telling you, he'll talk." So I thought, well, maybe it'll be Saturday night. So we all went Saturday night, and they had somebody else. Last chance, Sunday morning, got to be now. We introduced somebody else, and we all were terribly disappointed. Halfway through his talk, come up to stage. Guy starts, "Got some wonderful news. They've just brought Bill Wilson by ambulance. He's back of that backstage curtain. He's going about to say a few words." We all had tears in our eyes. We jumped up and clapped, and they pushed him out in his wheelchair, tubes in his nose, and all over, and that applause, you could just see the color come to his cheek. And he stood up, pulled himself up right here. "Boys and girls, I'm so glad to be here. So happy to all of us to remember that God is going to let us survive as long as we continue to do the work God has given us to do." And went on a few minutes, and everybody's excited and appreciative. He couldn't breathe. "I just want you to know that I'm very glad to be here." And he sunk back in his chair, and they wheeled him out, put him back in the ambulance, and a few minutes later, he was dead. But on the way back to the hotel that day, I was talking to John McHugh. I said, "John McHugh, how did you know that he was going to talk? He's a dying man." And he said, "Kid, you got to remember, they're wonderful people, but they're people. Do you think Bill Wilson would want it said that Dr. Bob talked while he was dying and Bill wouldn't?" That really is true. But anyway, that's the other thing to the convention. They had 12 guys get up there. These little tapes are fascinating. 12 guys get up there, one after another, and take a tradition and try to explain it to the membership to see if they will realize it's not threatening. And so they voted it in. That's where the traditions came from. The first convention, 1960, or 1950, in Cleveland, Ohio. And these same traditions today, as John mentioned so well today, are assailed on all sides, as they have been even before they were conceived. You know, what do you mean anonymity? Wouldn't we help people if we had more famous people say they were in AA? We could draw people here. Sounds reasonable. Probably would work. Except it might kill the person whose anonymity was shot. They don't seem to realize that. Why can't we help everybody? Because people that try to help everybody wind up helping nobody. That's why. And why do you have to have a desire? Why do you have to be an alcoholic to be a member of AA? Because that's the nature of the basic tenet of Alcoholics Anonymous. And little by little over a period of time, if you want to, you can learn these things. But what it boils down to in the essence, in the last analysis, is always the same. Sooner or later, if we are to survive, we must go back to the basics. Back to the basics. And of all... You misunderstand. This is the applause signal. I was just scratching my ear. The only problem with the kind of talking like the way I'm talking right now is usually the people who need to hear it aren't there. You're not the ones who go do things like this. It's called in church preaching to the choir. You know, the sinners, they're still sleeping off their hangover. I'm preaching to these boobs in the choir who are already believe it. Okay, that's really good, Reverend, but can we sing now? See, Peggy has her pitch pipe out nervously. But all of us, not really preaching to the choir, but it seems like it sometimes. But the one, oddly enough, even the people who believe in it need to hear it a lot. I need to hear it a lot, and I believe it with every fiber of my being. Do you know why? Because I am a human being. And human beings are inconstant creatures. And nothing is wonderful after you're used to it. And these very things I can so easily take for granted. And I forget almost entirely what a terrible battle it was in my life to come to believe in these basics, that I almost died disbelieving in them. Died once, had to be brought back to life, so I could almost die again. And the basics here are quite simple. That there are several basics we have to confront. Probably the most common one that you and I have in common, and it's this way all over. That secret feeling which left to itself tells me, but you really are different. You really are different. You may have drunk the way they did, some of them did, but your problems are a little different than theirs. They don't understand. Probably the most common single feeling I've ever met. In the last year, I've had the opportunity to go to a lot of places that I haven't been before. Toured Australia in June, but even more dramatic in April. I guess I was the first one ever asked to come down and do that. Tour the cities of South Africa and talk at meetings, black meetings and white meetings and mixed meetings. And you know you're going to hear it all different there, different accents, but I'll tell you one thing. When you get to talking to them one-on-one, made no difference who the color, who they were, where they lived, Durban or Johannesburg or Cape Town or Mafeking. They talk about my feelings of being different. And my feelings, but you see, I'm different because I'm a South African. I'm different because I'm black. I'm different because I'm white. I'm different because I'm old. I'm different because I'm young. We all got the same reason. But it all boils down to something much deeper than that we all are familiar with, I'm sure. My emotions are different. That's what it is. I can't quite put it on it. So I'll say I'm different because I'm from white or black or something. But my emotions are different. A few years ago, I was shortly right after the wall came down. I was in Berlin talking at a dinner. And I was there, went to an English-speaking meeting the night before. I'll tell you how soon it was. I'd been up there that day, and I chopped pieces off the wall with my own little hook, pick. And so I could take home and give them to my grandchildren and remind them I loved them more than their other grandfather. Breaks up the steady diet at $2 and $3. I love you more than your other grandfather did. Here, put this rock. But I thought, sure, that night, because there was for the first time ever that I knew of, East Germans had come through who had been surreptitious AAs, or maybe a little interested in AA, and they were sitting in a meeting, an open meeting with West German AAs, and I was sitting there not as their speaker, just as a listener, and it was just fascinating. People were going up and down the Unter den Linden for the first time from both sides of the wall, just exciting, and you know you're going to hear something that's going to be dynamic. And you hear some guy behind you say, but I don't think you really understand. I'm afraid my case is different. See you down to the coffee shop, Hunts. And that feeling of difference, I think, is what kills alcoholics. Now, you say everybody's got this feeling at one level or another. You may think you've gotten rid of it, but wait till the next time you're hungry or cross or somebody hurts your feelings, you'll see it appear again briefly. Because you're a human being first and foremost. It's a sad piece of news to discover that no matter how hard you work the program, you never rise above human being. And human beings have some good faults, some good things and some bad things. And all the program does is try to increase the percentage of good things and decrease the percentage of bad things. But when you hear people who have risen above all of us, there's a Spanish word that you can sing to them. Adios. You know. See you down to the treatment center, Lamar. They say things, I no longer need AA, I walk alone with God. And it sounds beautiful till one day apparently God gives them a beer. Pretty nasty thing to do, but maybe it's for their own good, I don't know. But we have to deal with being a human being. I sometimes talk about this a lot. You know, sometimes I think I've had moments where I've just felt transformed by the people and the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at times I've thought, I've broken the barrier. I'm now into a state of spiritual awareness that I'll be in for as long as I live. And I could help people just by touching them, perhaps. Then some old bag cuts me off on the freeway and it's all over. The new spiritual leader of 500 million Muslims has his window down in a 16th of a second saying, "You bitch! What the hell's wrong with you?" Well, I'd better work on my spiritual breakthrough again today. But AA has changed. AA enables you to change actions. When I chase someone on the freeway, I try not to, but if I am forced to by fate, I never chase anybody past my exit. I used to. I used to go to West Covina sometime before I could counsel them. Now, if I haven't got them by 4th Street, we... Good flying, Red Baron, but we'll meet again. And the problem with AA is when you do catch them, you can't do anything. All you can do is go by and give them the ray. That's all I'm permitted to do. A few years ago, I was coming off the Santa Monica Freeway, right under the Harbor Freeway, and a little girl didn't even see me or didn't even care to look and almost put me into an overpass. And I'll tell you, it was nip and tuck, Barney Oldfield. And I thought, well, I hate to do this. I'm a little short on time, but I must get her past my exit. We got out about Avenue 19 somewhere before I was able to come up next to her. And I gave her a quadruple ray. I suddenly realized she's only about 17. A little blonde girl, pretty little blonde girl, probably in her dad's car. And I have a granddaughter at that time. My granddaughter looked, acted the same age, looked just like her. And how would I feel if little Katie Doherty made a funny turn by accident and then some old goof pursued her to give her a quadruple ray? So I've changed, put on my AA smile, I smiled, and she went, "Oh, oh, oh, oh." The point I'm making is that these things come up in life. I'm sure many people handle them better than I do. But I handle them pretty well most of the time, once in a while. That's why they say don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, because your resistance gets down. When you're hungry, you'll discover that people act stupid. I don't know why, they just know you're hungry. When you're angry, God would like to have you shoot them with a gun. For their own good, I guess. But on and on. So the point, those are the basics of AA again. The basics are, you must take care of yourself, you must follow certain regimes, but primarily you must accept and continue to remember the nature of why you are not so different. And you do that by beginning to understand my problem. I was in and out of AA for 9 years. The worst years of my life came after I came to AA. Good people tried to help me. Fine people went to the wall for me. We were talking yesterday down in Mexico, talking to somebody who remembered this in Dallas. I had a bunch of sick, we're not kids, but they kept having accidents and falling down. My oldest daughter, in fact, you must remember, asked Charlotte about this, hadn't you, get home. I was home one night, one day I was trying to stay home with my kids and be all right. And my daughter fell off the porch, apparently. She broke her leg, 9 years old. And I rushed out and I said, oh God, I'm so glad I'm here. I picked her up and I ran in the house and I forgot she was longer than the aperture was and I broke her other leg. Not my fault. My father never nurtured me. I don't want to talk about it. But I was in and out of AA for years. And worst years of my life came after I was in and out of AA. Good people, well, I started to say in Texas. In that town, things were so bad, I had to go to the AA and find a pediatrician who was an alcoholic and ask him to be my sponsor so he could take care of my kids for no cost. Well, I had just come off electric shock treatments. I couldn't be responsible for everything. But the last day I drank, I'd just been thrown out of a Skid Row mission downtown Los Angeles, a corner that John and I and some others stand on every Wednesday noon on our way to lunch. We stand right, that piece of sidewalk. And the guy said, stay out of here, you bum. And I tried to explain to him, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write were running that very week in Life and Time and Collier's and Saturday Evening Post, the Elsie and Elmer ads for the Borden Company. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. And unfortunately, I had my front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank about a few weeks before that, so I wasn't hitting those consonants quite as cleanly. But I stood outside of the midnight mission, and I felt I was dying, and I felt my life was over. And the guy came up to me and said, you know, you're dying, Slim. Now, you've been around AA, you've been in therapy, you've been all these things. Can you accept the fact you truly are an alcoholic? And if my life depended on it, I'd have to say, but I'm not really an alcoholic. My case is different. It is truly different. If it weren't, I would like to be an alcoholic. That's a hell of a lot simpler than anything I got going for me now. But I'm not. And I never could really put my finger on it, but I can see in retrospect why I always could decide I was not really an alcoholic. And I was disappointed. I went to a lot of different cities, thought, maybe I am and I'll fit right in. But I never was after a while. Because of one thing. Alcoholics are people whose problem is alcohol. And as a result of that, they drink alcohol and get drunk and their lives get all screwed up emotionally and they feel bad. And they come to AA and AA shows them how to get sober and they get sober and their lives get unscrewed up and they start feeling better and they're grateful. And in some odd way, I'm like that. But just the opposite, almost a counterpolar thing. It seems like when I stay sober too long, my emotions get all screwed up. My life gets all screwed around and I feel so bad. I drink to feel good. The same way they get sober to feel. And sometimes I get drunk. And well-meaning people think, oh, here's a fellow whose problems are caused by drinking. So they say, you get sober, kid, and you'll be all right. And time after time I did. But then after a while I began to realize, quite obvious, when I get sober, I go back to the condition those people had when they were drinking. Pain, conflict, loneliness, sadness, rejection, despair. I hit it all, because real men in my generation don't wimp out. But by God, I certainly knew it. Oh, there were a few times when I had surges of hope, when I'd get sober and take a vow with somebody, put my hand on a Bible, or do something on my child's head or something. But if you're like me, that doesn't help. Sooner or later, it's going to be 2 o'clock in the morning. You're going to be lying there one night. You can't sleep. And all of a sudden, through the wall, through the door, here come your old pals. They've been gone on a trip, but now they're back. Here comes resentment and feelings of being screwed around by people. And loneliness. And knowing my case is different. And knowing I've been victimized by them all along. And a lot of it's my parents' fault. And a lot of it is the things I learned in psychoanalysis, how when I discovered that I'd always been a victim. And on and on and on. And when those feelings come back, it isn't going to be long now. Maybe that day, maybe a week, maybe a month. Very rarely a month. But the day's going to come. And someone was describing it once. I don't know if I ever tried to describe it before, but I understand this feeling. When you've been really feeling bad, and you're on the wagon, and you're trying to do whatever you can, and suddenly you make a decision, after work tonight, or after work, after supper tonight, I'm going to go out and get a drink. And you just feel a mounting excitement. Just like waiting for Christmas. It's just around the corner. And it's just that feeling, oh man, I completely forget the vows and everything else. I'm going to have relief. It's excitement. I'm going to be a man tonight. Today I'm a wimp, but when I drink, I'm a man! And it's that mounting excitement. I remember once talking with a guy who I sponsored. He'd taken his inventory. And he'd had some trouble as a rapist. I thought, how odd it is. How he talks about how he's disgusted by his raping of women. But when the time comes that he starts to make his move again, that mounting excitement starts in. As sick and terrible as it is, it's that mounting excitement. Tonight is going to be the night. Same way, felt that same way about drinking. And drinking maybe did as bad for me. And then you drink. And sometimes you control it for a little while. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes I've controlled it for a while. And sooner or later, the jackpot. And then people say, why'd you do it? And I don't know why I did it. So the answer is, leave me alone, son of a bitch. Because I don't know what the answer is. So I'll be tough. Or I'll be macho. Or I'll just say, I'm getting out of here. To hell with you. And to go to AA, where well-meaning, nice people are saying, if you'll stop drinking and return to God and get some spiritual concepts... I wish that worked for me, pal. I wish that worked for me. I'd be there in a New York minute. But it doesn't work for me. First place, I'm not about to return to God, because if God exists, I am damned anyway. I was raised in a church that left me no doubt where God was. I used to laugh about it, hear people say, I've been searching for God. I've known where God was since I was 2 years old. He slowly circles the Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And he gives it to sinners. And he gives it to Catholics. Which isn't all bad. If you want to clean up the world, get rid of sinners and Catholics. Unfortunately, when I was growing up, I had a great zeal. I was a good Lutheran boy. I did my catechism. I could sing songs in Norwegian. I had one little drawback, and it screwed up my life. It turned out that I'm the kind of guy who needs a little more fun than the other Lutherans. And that little fun translates into little sins here and there. And pretty soon, kind of bigger sins. And pretty soon, I become a sinner. And pretty soon, I'm monking with Catholics. And pretty soon I'm sinning with Catholics. And it's all over. I've done some terrible things in my time. I didn't mean to, but I've done them. I remember telling a guy once, it's hard to reform when you've broken all 10 commandments. I thought about that years later. I thought, that isn't really true. That's an exaggeration. Thank God. I haven't broken all 10 commandments. I've never coveted my neighbor's manservant. It's not a hell of a lot, but it's a beachhead, we call it. And that's why it's kind of strange for me tonight to be flying in here from Los Angeles this morning so I can stand at this podium tonight, be with people I know and love, some I don't know, but who I love, to say a funny thing happened on my way to my grave. One more time, I was thrown away and desperate, alone and afraid, and I had no more desire to stop drinking the last day I drank than I had desire to fly to the moon, or I realized it, anticipation I would. I hear people say, well, I had to stop drinking, alcohol stopped working for me. I guess that's what happens. Alcohol still worked for me. It didn't work as well, but by God, it's the only thing I had. It wasn't a big boom, but it was a modified boom. Sure was better than anything else. And I had no idea why. To get out of the rain, I walked 71 blocks from the Midnight Mission out to an AA club that I'd been asked to leave a week before for being in there drunk and fighting. And I'd walk in there and I would not drink from then till now. Who would have guessed such a thing? I wouldn't even want it to happen. Now it's been almost 35 and a half years. I haven't had a drink or a pill. I haven't had any therapy except Alcoholics Anonymous, which I already knew all about. There was nothing new here for me. I knew all about AA. I could recite the steps. I could do all sorts of things. And that is the mystery of AA. How is it one day you're possible to do it? I was talking the other night, or I guess it was Christmas, wasn't it? Somewhere. So I tried to explain that it's a much smaller way, but there's an analogy to AA that's very simple. Teaching someone how to ride a bicycle. There is nothing you can say that will teach someone how to ride a bicycle. You can tell them how to get on the damn thing and how to move the pedals and steer, but boom, down they go. And you say, well, do it again. I don't want to do it again. We're going to do it again. No one can explain how they can ride a bicycle, because one moment you cannot ride it. And one moment later, for no way that you can explain, you suddenly get that gift called balance. And you don't know how you got it, but you'll have that balance for as long as you live. You can ride a bicycle forever the rest of your life, but you cannot tell someone else how to ride a bicycle. And in a strange way, it almost seems sobriety is that same way. You can do it and hang around here and sit here like John was saying, sit in the garage, wait to become a car. And it doesn't happen. Something happens along the way, probably not quite as fast and as simple as riding a bicycle. But one day you can stay sober. And then you try to explain how to stay sober to people who can't stay sober, and they don't understand that you understand. And they say, I don't want to. Yes, you do. And that is the whole conundrum, enigma of Alcoholics Anonymous, that no one can really understand, least of all people outside of here, but most of all people in here can't understand it either. And that's why you cannot trust your judgment. And that's why you cannot trust your understanding. And that is why you cannot trust what seems right to you, because it has never been effective in this globe, in this arena before. That is why you and I must surrender to the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to understand them. You don't have to know them. You don't have to have an insight into them. But you must do them. And like many people I know, my problem always was, although I didn't see it, I sought the why and wherefore and didn't want to do them till I understood them. And if you do that long enough, you die. Or even worse than die, stay alive feeling bad for a long, long time. To me, it never bothered me when people said, for you to drink is to die. Man, I was in the nut house for a suicide. I wish I would die tonight. It's a lot more lethal and more correct to say, for you to drink is to make sure that you'll feel bad even a lot longer than you think you can stand. Day after day, week after week, month after month. So that's why it's always imperative we get back to the basics. And the basics begin with this. Actions and belief that the actions will work. Can't always believe the actions will work. Hardly anybody does when they come here. I mean, you look at those steps. They're nothing gag a maggot, you know, when you're feeling desperate. You know, I'm going to admit I am a terrible old drunk, and God's going to make me sane again. Not even crazy, really, but I'm going to turn all my problems over to Jesus. Here, Jesus. Boom, boom, get him. I'm going to write down things I wouldn't even tell my psychiatrist and tell them to some loudmouth babbler that I don't even trust. Did you know I used to be married to a sheep outside of Butte, Montana? You know. Ask God to get rid of all my sins so I'll be like the people I've always hated. Get little thin blue lips. And I wouldn't choose to do that. That seems like that might be pleasure. Make amends to people who've been screwing me for 30 years. Here's $10 for calling the police on me that time. Hope it didn't tie up your phone too long. More inventory in case there's anything you might have successfully forgotten. Keep digging. Oh, there's one. There's one. Meditation. Great step for suicidals. Just sit in a dark room. Have your pistol right with you, sir. And if you survive all that, what's your reward? Happiness? Joy? Love? You're going to be allowed to drive across town and let somebody puke on your shoes. And that is what makes AA such a strange place. And that's why it's impressive that we understand the nature of the problem and why we have the steps and the traditions. And I'm not going to talk very long about it. I'm not going to give you a long discharge. I'm going to give you quite short form. But the gift you and I have been given is a gift we take for granted and is not for granted. It has only been given, apparently only been utilized twice. Once by the Washingtonians and once by us. There's no information in AA that's worth anything different than anything else. I can find you an endless amount of material that I could refill that book 10 times using the same stuff. The book is not what made AA successful. The book wasn't written till after people were staying sober. Certainly wasn't the meetings. Certainly wasn't love. Some people hate each other in a lot of cases. What is it that made AA successful? What does AA have in connection with the Washingtonians, the only two successful organizations in the world? These are the only two attempts at the treatment of alcoholism predicated upon one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. That is the only difference from all the other therapies ever tried. It's not doctors, lawyers, counselors, well-meaning friends, children, parents. One alcoholic, to little by little, when you stop and think about it, you read the early days if you haven't read about them. Dr. Bob, or Bill Wilson before that, talking about how he had known Ebby was a terrible drinker. He had known Ebby was a terrible drinker, so he had at least that insight. So when Ebby told him he was staying sober, he was startled and listened to what he said. But Dr. Bob didn't know Bill Wilson from Adam's Off Ox. So Bill Wilson told Dr. Bob how he felt and how he drank. And Dr. Bob Smith was staggered because he was talking about him. My God, you're the first person I ever understood that ever understood or felt. And after they sat around and discussed spirituality for 2 weeks till finally Dr. Bob got drunk. And then they realized, not because of that, but because of something else, they realized Bill had stayed sober by trying to help other people. So they went up to the hospital in Akron, Ohio, and found AA number 3, Bill D. And he was a lawyer from Kentucky who had moved up there at a geographic and had a deep southern accent. He was married to a very strong woman. I met her, and him. I've heard them both and heard him talk. I mean, the kind of woman who, when you ask him, "How you doing, Bill?" She says, "He's fine." Made me a little homesick. But he had been under, everyone grinded him about drinking. He was sick of hearing about drinking. He didn't want to hear any more about it. In his talks, he said, "I was laying in that bed in Akron, Ohio. My wife said two fellers wanted to come in and talk to me about my drinking." And I thought, "Oh, drat. I don't want to talk to anybody about my drinking, but my wife thought it'd be a good idea, so I did." And them two fellers never talked about my drinking once. They talked about their drinking and their feeling. And they were just like me, the first people I ever heard like that. And I was so impressed, I stuck with them fellers and been with them ever since. And ever since, the message is one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic. To take the actions. The actions are all very nice, but why would you take them when you don't believe in them and you can see they're not effective? That is the hardest hurdle you and I'll ever have to maintain in our life to control, to go over. And that's why these things about the traditions and the things about what we're doing here and this singleness of purpose and the primary purpose has to be so well entrenched in these basics. Because what Alcoholics Anonymous is in the bottom example, it is not love, it is not spirituality, it is not the book, it is not the meetings, it is not anything like that. These are all wonderful things, and they are strong adjuncts to AA. But they are not AA. AA is as it has always been. June 10th, 1935 to February 5th, Huntsville, Alabama. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. That is the message of AA. Everything else is secondary to that. And we lose it. It's such a simple thing. And that is why we have to maintain this. That is why, as John was saying today, I try to understand overeaters. I was asked to speak at some of their early meetings. But I never really been able to understand a woman that will eat 2 gallons of ice cream. You know, not my problem. People say, "I ate so much I had to put my finger down my throat." No, don't bother to thank me after the meeting. You know. I was there speaking on obsessions, and I helped them a lot, because I'm not on the recovery from obsessions. I haven't learned that yet, but I could talk about obsessions. But it's the same thing, you know. It doesn't do it for me. I can, to this day, I've been really working with narcotics addicts for over 25 years. And I like to think I know as much about it as a lot of people. But when a narcotics addict gets up in my meeting and talks about shooting up and all the things he did, ho-hum, baby. It doesn't do anything for me. Because I always felt different than that. Now, I know today there are people in AA who drank and took drugs. We have no objection with that. All you have to make sure is that one of the problems you have is being an alcoholic. Then whatever else you can be, you can be. But I would suggest to you that your ability to be of service to God and man at the podium will be enhanced in AA if you talk about what alcohol did for you and why you are here dealing about it. Not to put narcotics down, but that's why they formed Narcotics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, all these other groups, so people could identify, because that's the hard thing. It's easy to understand all the damn steps. The problem is, why should I do them when I won't till I identify? Till I'm desperate. So that's why these basics are absolutely so important. And yet sometimes, because we're human beings, we get sober a while. And yeah, that's all very nice, but maybe we should be off doing something else. Maybe we should get some more movie stars. Maybe we should do this. Maybe we should do that. And it sounds fine. It's all kind of fun. Go to conventions. Talk about what we did today. We have to talk about it. Set up your home group. You can go to meetings sometimes and never hear alcohol mentioned once. What did you do today? What did you feel today? No one ever mentions, you know, "I used to drink and now I'm sober." Or other reverse of that, you go to meetings where people just one after another tell long, tedious, goddamn drinking stories, and they tell the same one every meeting, and nobody ever gets a chance to talk about recovery, which is equally wretched. We are in the business of, we were sick and now we're getting well. That's what's wrong with these victimization programs, at least for people like me. They want to find out again and again what got me sick. I haven't got time for that much longer. I've come to the conclusion I know what got me sick. Something over there. It's the old analogy I've used a lot of times. I still don't know a better way to put it. I've lived most of my life as though I were on the deck of the Titanic. And it hits the iceberg and down it goes. And everybody rows away as fast as they can. And people like me say, I'm not getting off this baby till I find out why this happened. And you may find out why. You may have counseling and find out why. And it gives you a great feeling of superiority. You people out there shivering in the boats. Ha, ha, ha. I know why. It takes a while. Knowing why you're going down is of secondary importance at best. How do I get off the sinking ship? That's what we do here. I think that's another great basic to me is sponsorship. I travel around a lot in the world. A lot of people do. I see pockets of enthusiasm. Peggy's pocket of enthusiasm, that little two-bit town of Bellevue, Nebraska, has more happy sobriety than the rest of the state combined. Pocket of enthusiasm. Johnny Harris is meeting down in Lakewood. He goes down there any other night, and you think you're in the wax museum. But not that meeting. They're up. All over the world, there are pockets of enthusiasm. And every time you find a pocket of enthusiasm, you will find a meeting or a group predicated on strong sponsorship. And the reason is not just coincidence, but with strong sponsorship, people get into doing things that they would never do on their own. My sponsor says, do this. If my head said, do that, I'll see. You know, little by little, and if you're surrounded by all people who are doing it, they pull you right along with the tide. It's just like being swept down a river. But if you're trying to do it by thinking it, you'll die. So really, you know, we can talk all we want about the esoterics, and we do. We talk about the stories, and they're all interesting, and the manifestations, and what the book really means. There's a movement now in AA of people who get together to discuss what the book really means. I'm rather educated, and I'm rather intelligent, and I'm quick and facile, and I'll tell you, I can just barely make it with what it apparently means. I'm so dumb, I think it means what it says. But even the tapers are peeling out. But I want to say that's why we're here, to discuss the basics. Back to the basics. It's the theme of this convention. It should be the theme of our lives about every 2 or 3 weeks. Because we're all a bunch of esoteric goofs. Not really. But we have a tendency to want a little more color. But I know that myself, that's why I still go to meetings. I don't hear anything. I haven't heard anything new in a meeting in over a quarter of a century. That's true. And yet every time I leave a meeting, I feel better somehow. Why is that? Because I have back to basicized a little bit, if it's a good AA meeting. And the actions I take not because I'm a wonderful man, just the opposite. I'm a weak, emotional man in my own thing. But when I take these actions, stay in the basics, it redresses where I'm off base, and I get almost stable. I think about that. I tore a ligament in my knee. They're going to operate on it next Tuesday. But for a while, it really is very inconvenient, very difficult, and I have to limp a lot, and it's really a pain in the butt. But I know that's where my emotions are. And Now they're going to do some arthroscopic surgery on this. Take 2.5 hours next week. My emotions aren't quite that easily gotten to. I have some arthroscopic surgery that's going to take 48 years. But to do the same thing, it provides me with the redress of the imbalance. And the single most important thing I know is the actions of AA. The actions, the involvements, the doing what you say you're going to do. The greatest spiritual lessons I have learned in my life. I've learned some great spiritual lessons as a boy. But the greatest spiritual lessons I have ever learned, I learned here. And I never knew they were spiritual lessons until years later. Do what you said you would do. Be where you said you would be, when you said you would be there, or let them know you're not going to be there. Don't take out your hostilities on people who can't answer back. Waiters, waitresses, children, employees. If you must take out your hostility, take it out on someone who's in a position to answer back. I remember once I was feeling very, very cross at the AA club when I was sober a couple of years. I just was going to lay it on this Gussie Simpson that ran the bar because my hamburger was sick. And I was about to let her have it, and I said, I can't hold it back, Bob. My sponsor says, I know you got to take it out. Take it out on Mike Ross. And I walked over to Mike Ross, 6'4", healthy at that time, big moose. I said, Mike. He said, yeah. How's it going? I discovered I was able to stuff it after all. But it's a continuing, ongoing thing. You know, earthquakes seem tough, but earthquakes in California aren't anywhere as bad as the earthquakes in my head if I let them happen. That's because there's no aftershocks. It's a perpetual. And that's why I come and sit in meetings. So this will not happen to me ever again. That is why I do what I'm asked to do. I have not consciously said no to an AA request in 35 years. Since my sponsor insisted I not do it. I have tried to, to the best of my limited ability, be kind and gentle. I fail at this all the time. Not so much as I used to. But the great gift of AA is that every night here is New Year's Eve. I can make my resolutions tonight for a whole new year starting tomorrow. I don't have to wait till next January 1st. And tomorrow I may screw them up. But tomorrow night is New Year's Eve by a break of luck. And I can do it again. And little by little you learn to live with a little degree of peace. And what the basics have done for me, they taught me that I was an alcoholic. That the problems I had were something called alcoholism. That taking a series of actions would alter my perception of reality as much as alcohol did, but in a different direction. That it has enabled me to walk with some degree of dignity in the world. That it has come to allow me to talk to a God that, much to my absolute amazement, over a few years, I came to believe actually loved me. And I would have bet everything I had that he wanted to kill me and put me in hell. I believe he loves me the same as he loves you, no more, no less. He loves me exactly the same as the man. Monday morning when I go to work, I step over the bodies of dying men in front of my office. Not very many people have that opportunity. He loves them the same as he loves me. Just somewhere along the line, I was able to grasp it, and they weren't. So I could, if you thought all day, you couldn't think of a better subject. The back to basics. Back to doing the things. Back to being a person among persons. Of being kind and good. Of trying to remember with our selfishness and our self-will run riot and our pettinesses and our hungers and losses, and all this crap that you and I must live with. That here there's something called love and service. We all know what love is. We all know what service is. We don't have to work up definitions. And none of us would be here. The man ahead of us hadn't put a pat on the back, so we all remember to give a pat on the back to the man behind us. Let us remember to watch that erring member of the tongue so that we can choose to judge others with it as kindly as possible. As all these things Dr. Bob said when he knew he was dying, he wanted to put his testament together. And he said, this to the end that we shall live in peace and harmony and sobriety. And I trust that we will. And I trust that God will continue to let us flourish, as Bill said, as long as we continue to do so. Thank you.